Christian County was hit the hardest. Many families completely lost everything, lost their entire homes.
That's Governor Rauner in Taylorville speaking to ABC 7 Chicago. Dozens of people have been injured in that town after it was hit by a tornado this past weekend. We'll get an update from local officials on the ground. Plus, a number of states are suing the federal government to keep the citizenship question off the 2020 census.
And when you then have communities that are already weary of filling out the form, not wanting to fill out the form, that risks not having a fair and accurate count.
That's Anita Banerjee with the Chicago nonprofit Forefront. We'll talk about what's at stake for Illinois in the next census and a new development on a story of unpaid debt for parking tickets, which turns out disproportionately affects communities of color in Chicago. After ProPublica investigated the issue, the city is now dismissing about 23,000 tickets. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll check in with Central Illinois and Christian County, which was hit especially hard by tornadoes this past weekend, and Chicago residents who have been targeted by unfair parking ticket practices are starting to see some relief, thanks in part to an investigation by ProPublica Illinois. But first, the Supreme Court announced last month that it will weigh in on the lawsuits over whether or not there should be a question about U.S. citizenship on the 2020 census. The justices have scheduled a hearing in February, but this debate has been going on outside of the high court for months now, ever since the Trump administration announced plans to include this question. And a number of states are part of lawsuits against the federal government, including Illinois. We know Illinois is losing residents, and because of that, we could lose one congressional seat after the next census. If non-citizens are undercounted, that could turn into two. Ted McClellan wrote about this for the Chicago Magazine, and he's on the line with us now. Also joining us, Rob Perrell, a demographer and fellow in the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
And from NPR's New York Bureau, we are joined by national correspondent Hansi Lo Wong, who has been covering the 2020 census. And welcome back to you, Hansi.
Thank you, Liz.
So, Ted, I want to start with you. In your article, you describe how you worked as an enumerator, I believe it's called, in the 2010 census for the U.S.
Yes.
What exactly does that entail?
Well, I had to go out and find people who hadn't returned their census forms. So that involved, you know, trying to get into apartment buildings, knocking on doors, you know, convincing people who might have been reluctant to participate in the census to participate in the census.
And Ted, in particular, I believe you were stationed in Rogers Park, which you describe as one of the most immigrant-heavy neighborhoods in Chicago, if not the country. So for those of us who haven't been to that location in Chicago, could you describe Rogers Park for us?
Well, sure. I remember one afternoon when I was in a building and I, you know, we would ask people, we didn't ask people citizenship, but we asked them background or nationality and race. And there was one afternoon when I counted people from seven different countries in one single apartment building. So quite a few of the people that I did have to go out and find were immigrants.
So when you're talking to them, I assume this question to citizenship came up from them, maybe perhaps a little bit of apprehension or fear in filling this out. So how did you handle those questions when you're knocking on doors?
Well, I mean, we never asked about citizenship in the 2010 census.
But I mean, would people ask, I mean, return that as a reason why they maybe have not filled it out?
You know, I don't remember anybody particularly saying that. But again, you know, that wasn't anything that was actually asked on the census, whether you're a citizen or not.
Right. So it's not a concern at all at that point.
At that point, no. No, it wasn't. And, you know, the Constitution says you have to count all persons, no matter who they are. And the way I see it, it's not, you know, if you have an objection to non-citizens or illegal immigrants being counted in the census, that's not really something for the Census Bureau to deal with. You know, your argument is with, the immigration authorities. The census is, you know, just sort of a neutral body that has to count everybody who's in this country for whatever reason.
And Hansi, for the 2020 census, what does the Trump administration plan to ask exactly?
the wording of the question is this person a citizen of the United States? And there are multiple options. You can answer yes, born in the U.S., or born in Puerto Rico, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, other territories, or born abroad of U.S. citizen parent or parents, or you can say you're a U.S. citizen by naturalization and you print the year that you became a U.S. citizen, or you check off the box that says no, not a U.S. citizen. And this is wording of a citizenship question that is asked on a Census Bureau survey known as the American Community Survey. It does not go out to all households. It's not the census. But this is the exact wording that they that the Trump administration has moved over, essentially, to the 2020 census. And it's important to point out that the last time the Census Bureau asked all households about U.S. citizenship status was back in 1950. And it was a different kind of question, not the question that that's being debated about for 2020.
And as Ted pointed out, and we want to be very clear, it's never been the goal, maybe outside of that example that you just gave, that the census would count anything other than the people who are living in this country, trying to get a head count, right? So, Hansi, with this citizenship question, what exactly does the Justice Department say they want to achieve by asking it? Do we know?
The Justice Department was the agency that requested the citizenship question onto the 2020 census. And they say they want better citizenship data at a more detailed level than the government currently collects through the American Community Survey. They want that data to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 2, which has protections against racial discrimination and discrimination of language minorities. And essentially, the government needs to know how many citizens are in a given neighborhood, for example, or a district, and also figure out how many of those citizens are voting age to figure out if a specific minority group's voting power is being diluted. There's a process to figure that out, so you need some data to do that. And ever since the Voting Rights Act has been enacted, that's back since 1965, the government has used not census data, but from data from a survey that the Census Bureau has collected. It used to be known as the long form of the census, did not go out to every household, and then it became the American Community Survey. So essentially, the government did not ask for citizenship data from every household in the country. Now the Trump administration says it wants to do that, so it has more detailed data to better enforce these Voting Rights Act protections. And there are a lot of skeptics, however, within the voting rights community, civil rights groups that say they don't buy that reasoning. And they're very concerned that asking this question could discourage non-citizens from participating, given this current political climate of increased immigration enforcement and anti-immigrant rhetoric around the country.
And Hansi, I imagine that the states that are suing right now aren't buying this either, correct?
Exactly. Illinois is one of more than a dozen states, as you mentioned earlier, part of the two lead lawsuits here in New York. I've been following them. And there are also California is another state that has a separate lawsuit in California. There are seven lawsuits currently in total over the citizenship question. And the major concern here, again, is that this will discourage non-citizens from participating, and that could impact the accuracy of the information collected for the census, which has implications on how congressional seats and electoral college votes are distributed amongst the states over the next decade, as well as how $800 billion a year in federal funding is distributed to states and local communities based on population counts.
And a lot of this comes back to representation, kind of what you're talking about here. Critics of the citizenship question look at the administration's motives. If the question intimidates immigrants, that would work to the president's advantage. As of 8 out of 10 states with the largest percentage of foreign-born residents voted for Clinton back in 2016. So, Rob, what do we know about Illinois in particular when it comes to foreign-born population?
So Illinois is one of the big immigrant states. 1 out of 7 people in the state is foreign-born, or foreign-born populations, about 2 million people. But what's important is that when you have a lot of foreign-born folks in a state like Illinois, you also have a lot of native-born folks who live with them. In other words, they have spouses and they have children. So the population that's affected when you target immigrants in some way or make immigrants maybe not want to fill out a form, it extends and ripples out into the larger Latino and Asian populations in an immigrant and in a diverse state like Illinois.
And Rob, how much does the population loss factor in here? Certainly we've heard from state politicians and things like that, but what role does that play in all of this when it comes to the census?
So we need a good census count in Illinois more than most other places. We have 18 congressional districts. We are pretty much predicted to lose at least one. And here's the reason why the census matters, and why it matters that we count immigrants and Latinos and Asians who live with immigrants, is every congressional district in Illinois, outside of Metro Chicago, every single one of them is losing population. They're all losing from 10,000 to over 20,000 people just since 2010, the latest census shows. The only growth in all of these districts is coming from non-white populations. So instead of losing 10,000 or 20,000 people in Bustos or La Hood or Kinzinger or Shimkus's districts, they would lose 15 or as many as 30,000 people.
So
you've got to count the hard to count non-white populations, or you're going to have even worse numbers than you're already trending with.
And so, Rob, I think what we're getting here is that we talked about Rogers Park earlier, right? This very immigrant-heavy neighborhood in Chicago. So people think, well, that's their neighborhood. That's not my neighborhood. But you're saying that people are going to feel this throughout the state for a variety of reasons. Am I correct?
Population change in the United States involving immigrants and non-whites or people of color is not just an urban thing anymore. All of the growth that we get in rural Midwest, not just in Illinois, basically all of the growth is from people of color, especially from Latinos. You specifically don't count that population when you make things hard or when you dissuade immigrant families, which are often Latino families, from filling out their census form.
So, Ted, in terms of the stakes, we do know that we are on the path to losing a House seat because of the lower population,
right.
And you think another one is vulnerable. Would you say it's – go ahead.
Oh, yeah, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, would you say that it's safe to say that no other state really has more to lose than Illinois in this question?
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument I made. And another point, because we have the combination of population loss and heavy immigrant population, I think more than any other state does. But another point I want to make is, how do you verify this or enforce this? I mean, when we went door to door, we just had to take everybody's word for everything. I mean, if somebody told us they were Asian and they looked African-American, we had to put down that they were Asian. So, and people are going to be at home filling out these forms. They can do whatever they can say whatever they want on them. Short of asking everybody for a birth certificate or a naturalization papers, which isn't really part of the census process, how do you verify who is a citizen and who isn't a citizen?
And that's a very valid question. And I was kind of curious to get back to a point you made earlier. And I want to hear from both of you. Hansi, we'll go with you first. Do you have a sense in talking with people, how is this going to affect people's participation in the census?
Well, the Census Bureau actually did research about this. It hired consultants to do focus groups and to prepare for their marketing campaign to encourage households around the country to participate in the 2020 census. And they found out that through these focus groups, people are saying essentially that this is a major barrier to participating in the census. And this is a major barrier not only for folks who may be undocumented in the country, but folks who are connected to people who are undocumented. And this is across ethnic groups, this focus group research found. Folks think that this question is a way for the federal government to specifically locate people without documentation in the country. And it's important to remember, though, that federal law prohibits the Census Bureau from releasing any information identifying individuals for 72 years until after it's collected. And so information identifying you and your demographic information cannot be released to the public, cannot be released to federal agencies, including ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the FBI and local police departments. However, there's a perception out there that could happen, and that is a major concern that the plaintiffs here have raised, and the Trump administration is arguing that they believe that the follow-up work that census workers like Ted in 2010, that they go out door-to-door collecting information from households that don't respond themselves with the paper survey, or that the Census Bureau can send out those workers and also use statistical methods to make sure that there's an accurate count in 2020. The plaintiffs think that's very, very optimistic, given this current political climate, that this is going to be a very, very risky count in 2020.
And Ted, since you have knocked on doors and done that census work, would you agree with what Hansi is saying there?
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to make the census more time-consuming and more expensive. And, you know, immigrant groups, there is some evidence that they are already reluctant to participate and undercounted. I know an alderman in Chicago who said, every ward is supposed to have the same population. He represents a very heavily Mexican-American ward on the southwest side. He says he believes his ward has more people than any other because it produces the most garbage. But it was undercounted. So that's why it's got maybe 60, 65,000 as opposed to maybe 55,000 as most wards in Chicago have.
And Ted, real quick before we have to take a break, do we know where those House seats would be if Illinois loses them?
Well, I'm sure one would be downstate in southern Illinois. And I would say it's going to be hard to maintain three African-American seats in the Chicago area, given the population loss of African-Americans here.
Well, we do have to take a quick break here, but we want to continue this conversation. So stick with us here on the 21st. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting a booth at the Urbana Holiday Market in the Square December 8th and December 15th, featuring regional and special interest titles for every book lover on your list. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about a possible citizenship question on the 2020 census and how it would affect Illinois and the latest on the legal battle that's been going on about this issue for months now. I'm joined by NPR's Hansi Lo Wong and Ted McClellan from Chicago Magazine and Rob Perrell from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. So, gentlemen, thank you for sticking with me. And Hansi, I want to start with you. Getting back to this legal battle, because of the concerns like the ones we've been discussing, Illinois is one of more than a dozen states suing the federal government to prevent it from adding this question. So first, the trial went to court in New York last month, and that ruling could come down as early as next week or maybe even this week. But what are the plaintiffs trying to prove?
There are two main claims. The first one is that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau as the head of the Commerce Department, he allegedly misused his authority over the census by adding this question. And it's a question that former Census Bureau directors have testified that they believe it is not fully tested. The Census Bureau does years of testing before putting any question onto a census and any changes even to just slight wording or the ordering of questions. It's a very delicate instrument that could, small changes can have a big impact on the information collected. And these former Census Bureau directors are testifying that they believe that there should have been more testing done on this question. And that's part of the argument saying that why Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross misused authority, and also a claim that by adding this question, the Census Bureau and the Commerce Secretary are intentionally discriminating against immigrant communities of color. Given what the Census Bureau knows, this is the plaintiff's argument, given what the Census Bureau knows based on their research, that this could disproportionately affect immigrant communities, Latino communities, the effect of the citizenship question, and that also they are tying rhetoric from President Trump against immigrant communities, that they say that is pointing as examples of why this was intentionally discriminating against immigrant communities of color.
And the people at the Census Bureau have been doing this every 10 years since literally the beginning of the U.S. in its in our Constitution, right? So I gather from what you're saying.
Well, the Census Bureau was not formed at the beginning of the country, but there were U.S. Marshals on horseback that did this for the very first census in 1790.
Right. Yes. My apologies. Thank you for the correction.
It's okay.
There. But I do gather this is new ground for the census to be talking about a question of this nature, and that it's such a public, even political point of discussion. This is new grounds for them.
Well, again, the Census Bureau has asked about citizenship before of all households. The last time was in 1950 for the census, so that's not new ground. And it's also, you know, we as people not at the Census Bureau, and if you're not a Census Beat reporter, you're not thinking about the census all the time, but folks who do watch the census every 10 years, there is a pattern that this is a very controversial topic once we get close to a census year, because this is about how we divide up money and power in this country. And so any changes to it can have profound implications, again, not just for the census year, but for the 10 years on which we rely on this data to form our political system and how we divide up resources in this country.
And Rob, to you, ultimately, no matter what the ruling is, there is expected to be an appeal all the way up to the Supreme Court. And time is of the essence. There's a lot to do to prep for the census, now just almost about a year away. So we just have about a minute left. But Rob, I'd like to go to you.
Yeah.
In your position, the politics of this issue aside, why is getting an accurate count of people in Illinois so very important?
Well, getting an accurate count of people in Illinois is important because we're losing more population than most states are. And the population growth that we do have comes from precisely the communities that are less likely to fill out their census form, given the things we've discussed today. And I did want to throw in real quickly, regardless of what happens with this court case next week, the well has been very poisoned by this administration. Now, remember, it kicked off its campaign by attacking Mexican immigrants. And there's a whole litany of things that have been said about Mexicans that have Mexican and Latino and immigrant communities really upset and very not trusting any longer of the government. So a lot of damage has been done in terms of people's willingness to communicate with the government.
And that is all the time we have for this discussion today. I want to thank each of you for joining me. Hansi Lo Wong is a national correspondent with NPR based in New York. Rob Perel is a demographer and fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And Ted McClellan is a journalist who wrote about what Illinois stands to lose in the 2020 census for Chicago Magazine. To each of you, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome, Liz.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you're a regular listener to our program, you might remember a conversation we had back in March about how some Chicago residents are losing their jobs and having to file for bankruptcy because of parking tickets issued by the city. This ticketing process disproportionately affects communities of color, and it eventually became the subject of a ProPublica Illinois investigation. Since then, Chicago has slowly been changing their ticketing and debt collection process. And last week, the city announced that it has dismissed 23,000 outstanding duplicate vehicle sticker tickets. And they also said that they will refund drivers who have already paid for another 12,000 duplicates dating back to the early 1990s. For the latest on the story, I'm joined by Melissa Sanchez. Melissa is the reporter behind the story for ProPublica Illinois, and she's on the line from Chicago. Welcome, Melissa.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also joining me from WBEZ is Elliot Ramos, and he's also been working alongside Melissa on this story. Welcome to you, Elliot.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Melissa, just to start, when we say duplicate vehicle sticker tickets, first of all, that's a mouthful. But what exactly are we talking about? Can you tell us more about this particular ticket and why it plays such an important part in this story?
Yeah, sure. So in the city of Chicago, there's a requirement if you own and use a car in the city that you pay a tax. And the tax is between $87 and $130, depending on the weight of the vehicle. And if you pay the tax, you get a sticker that you put on your windshield, and that kind of proves that you're in compliance with the tax and you've paid the tax. If you don't have a sticker on your windshield and you're found on the city's streets, they can issue you a ticket that costs $200 for being out of compliance. And so what Elliot from BZ and I reported on over the summer were cases where people were getting hit with 2, 3, 4, and even 5 city sticker tickets in a single day. And those duplicate tickets, that's kind of the term that we've made up for them, are apparently against city code. The city's not supposed to issue more than one per day per vehicle, and they're disproportionately happening in Black and poor neighborhoods of the city. And so we care a lot about this particular kind of ticket, and there's dozens of different kinds of parking and vehicle compliance tickets in the city. But we're particularly interested in this ticket because, one, it's one of the most expensive in the city at $200 a pop, and then with late penalties, it can go up to $488. And two, because it's like clear that it's not a ticket that you get for parking badly or for being a bad driver. You get it because you failed to meet a financial obligation of the city.
Well, and so the duplicate part is that people can get this ticket multiple times just in one day. So not only is $200, that's a big price to pay right there, but then you have multiples and late fees and all of that. So is that how this particular ticket can then spiral into bankruptcy?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people file for bankruptcy, poverty, you know, job loss, et cetera. But so parking tickets are driving tens of thousands of people, mostly Black Chicagoans, into bankruptcy because if you accumulate enough unpaid tickets, the city can get your license taken away, they can take your car away. But because of the price of this ticket and the duplicates kind of compound the issue, then the amount of debt that you owe just escalates so much that bankruptcy becomes the best way out of your problem.
And Melissa, I want to play a clip from the last conversation we had on the show about this back in March, because I think it hits on what you're talking about here. This is Laquanda Reno, a Chicago woman who had filed for bankruptcy after being hit with tons of debt from unpaid tickets.
I had to choose between should I pay my rent or should I get this car off the boot? So I chose to pay my rent. And from there, I didn't drive because it came to a point where I said I cannot afford the parking tickets. I cannot afford the stickers. I just cannot afford it anymore. And it looked like a waste of money. I decided after 2 years of taking the train and the bus to get a car again. But in order for me to get a car again, I said, I don't want this debt to follow me. So I went to, and my license was suspended. So I didn't want to drive around illegally. And so I went to get the bankruptcy.
Again, that's Laquanda Reno, and she was talking with us about her financial issues stemming from these tickets. So, Melissa, do you find her story unique?
No, not at all. And that's the stunning part. I mean, last year, something like 10,000 people filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy, at least in part, to deal with tickets. So we know that they had debts to the city of Chicago. The vast majority of those debts were related to tickets. And so I can't say for sure that every single person who filed for bankruptcy filed specifically for tickets.
Of course.
But from talking to dozens of people, bankruptcy attorneys, experts, tickets, and the reason bankruptcy is helpful is because you can get your license back. You used to be able to get your car out of the impound. You could basically protect yourself from the city going after your car and your license. And that's so critical for getting to work, especially if you live in a part of the city where there's poor public transit. You might have to do the reverse commute to the suburb, et cetera. But your car is so important to your ability to live well that bankruptcy helps you do that.
Well, and when it comes to this idea that bankruptcy is the most appealing option, Elliot, I'm curious if you had anything to add to Melissa's answer.
One of the things that I've encountered, so, is just the city's towing program itself. A lot of people, when they reach a certain level of ticket debt, their cars get booted. And within 24-hour period, if you didn't have the funds to pay off the tickets in the first place, then your car gets booted. And within 24 hours, it gets towed, which the fees just compound astronomically. A lot of people do end up losing their cars to the city.
Well, and Elliot, to continue down this path, how does Chicago's ticketing practices disproportionately affect communities of color in this way?
Well, one of the things that we found out when we had to put the tickets on a map, and we started realizing that it started varying based on who was issuing the tickets. So a lot of people are familiar with parking enforcement aides with the vests. They usually go around where the meters are. But then there's also the Chicago Police Department, which can issue much more tickets, but there's a lot more of them on the south and west sides. These neighborhoods tend to be over-policed, but as a result, they also tend to ticket more. And a lot of these areas, particularly on the south side, don't have as dense of a population, so they end up getting more tickets for fewer people.
Well, and I think these are all very good reasons that you guys all started looking into this issue earlier this year. But I want to move on to the most recent news, which is the fact that 23,000 tickets were dismissed last week. So, Melissa, what do you know about why these tickets are being dismissed?
So Ellie and I first presented our data and our analysis on specifically the duplicate ticketing issue, which we just thought was, like, to be honest, we thought it was like a little story. We're like, hey, you guys, there's like, the city issues 3 million tickets a year. So, you know, a few thousand duplicate tickets a year isn't a huge drop in the, it's a drop in the bucket, but for these individuals, it's a big problem. We thought we would send the city the information. We sent them our analysis, the data. Here's all the tickets that were duplicates. Like, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
And they did nothing for 6 months. It wasn't until, by coincidence, last week on Wednesday, the city announces they're going to throw out all these tickets and refund money to people who paid for it, which is good news because these tickets never should have been issued in the first place. But it's hard to believe that it's not a coincidence that on this, like, a day later they get sued by somebody. The same guy who sued the city over like the camera stuff and won like a $38 million settlement sued over the duplicate tickets issues, which we uncovered. So, I mean, the city says one thing had nothing to do with the other. They were working on this for months. That could be true, but it sure helps that they managed to get this decision out the door before they got hit with a lawsuit.
Well, Melissa, could you briefly kind of get into a little more details about what the factors are behind the scenes? You kind of alluded to it with the lawsuit there, but what are you talking about?
I'm not sure what you mean by
that. The lawsuit filed by JC.
Yeah, so JC Zolna, who has sued the city on multiple occasions for issues related to tickets, he filed a lawsuit on Thursday of last week alleging that this duplicate ticketing practice is illegal, and he had a couple of clients of who he was representing. He also said the city does illegal duplicate ticketing on license plate expiration. So if you don't have expired plates, you can get hit with a $60 ticket, and on more than 100,000 occasions this has happened in the city. And so he basically took our analysis, expanded it, and filed a lawsuit. We've been bugging the city about this issue for 6 months. And,
yeah.
Go ahead.
So you're just saying that this happens to be a little bit too much of a coincidence for you, that this is all going down and then all of a sudden these tickets are dismissed.
Yeah. The city has said that it's been working on it for months. Just the timing is interesting. I can't say a whole lot more than that. But
yeah,
the good news is that they're getting rid of these tickets. And this matters, again, it's a drop in the bucket in the city's whole ticketing apparatus. But for individual drivers who have lost their licenses, who are in massive debt, this will be a relief.
Well, and Elliot, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that also for a lot of these individuals, it's might seem nice to say we're going to dismiss all these tickets. A lot of the damage was already done. Their licenses were suspended. Some of them declared bankruptcy, and many of them lost their cars. And the thing is, by saying that, like, oh, we shouldn't have been doing duplicate tickets in the first place, I just talked with an individual yesterday who got one snow ticket and two duplicate license plate tickets, and he, within a week, lost his car, and he wasn't able to get it back. So for him, the car's already gone.
Yeah, and the damage is already done. I think that's a valid point there. But looking forward, the steps that could be taken to reform the ticketing process, Elliot, do you have anything there that you're seeing that could be coming down the pipe or that you would like to see? And just to let you know, we about have a minute left.
I think there's pending legislation that's supposed to be voted on, I believe, this month that's going to examine some of the late fees. They're also looking at reforms for some of the license suspensions. But Melissa can also what was recently passed was to do a payment installment plan for the city sticker itself.
Yes.
Yeah, and some changes to how the city deals with bankruptcy. So there's some progress. There's a lot more to do.
That is all the time we have for this conversation. I've been talking with Melissa Sanchez from ProPublica, Illinois, and Elliot Ramos from WBEZ. Thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Most Illinoisans don't expect tornadoes to show up in December, but that's exactly what happened this past weekend when at least 20 touched down in parts of central and southern Illinois. One person has been reported dead in southwestern Missouri, and in Illinois, tornadoes have been confirmed in at least 7 counties. Christian County was hit especially hard, and in Taylorville, just southeast of Springfield, dozens of people have been injured and in some cases have lost their homes completely. Les Albert is an assistant public information officer with Christian County's Emergency Management Agency, and he's on the line with us now. And I'm also joined by meteorologist Andrew Pritchard. Les and Andrew, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you.
And Les, I'd like to start with you. As we said, Christian County was hit the hardest, and Governor Rauner was in Taylorville on Sunday, along with Congressman Rodney Davis, who's actually from Taylorville. So can you remind us just how much of Taylorville and Christian County was hit by this tornado?
Well, Christian County was hit in several different areas. It first started in the county in the southwest area around Morrisonville, where it went through a rural area and hit a dairy farm and some other farm buildings and homes, and it worked its way out through Hewittville, which is right at the southwest edge of Taylorville. That area got hit real hard, and I think the Weather Channel has told us that that was an EF3 tornado, maybe on the upper end of that.
Wow.
That area sustained heavy damage. Then it moved on through Taylorville and damaged several areas within Taylorville, left Taylorville, and went up through Stonington, which is north of Taylorville, and damaged several buildings there and moved on farther out into the rural area, damaging some farm implement buildings and stuff up there.
And Les, we've heard a lot of numbers in the past few days, but do you have an idea of just how many homes were hit in Christian County over the weekend?
In Christian County, I do not have that total number because they're still doing assessments even today up in the Stonington area.
Okay.
But our number in Taylorville, I believe, was approximately 100 severely damaged, 34 totally damaged, 56 received a lot of heavy structural damage, and then there were several hundred others that received damage to roofs and sidings and things.
Well, and I assume there are still parts of the area that don't have power. Is that correct?
That is correct. Now, the power company has done a great job of getting new poles put in and power to the facilities that safely can receive power. There are many places that weather heads are down, so they're not going to have power for quite some time. And again, many of the areas in the neighborhood are totally destroyed, and so it's going to take some time to rebuild that. But everybody has power that can safely receive power at this time.
Well, unless we hear things like there's curfew in Taylorville, could you tell me a little bit more about that and why there's curfew?
Well, we have a curfew at 9 p.m. The county sheriff has set that up, and it seems to be working quite well because of safety factors. We don't want the people out there because, again, there are trees down. There are no lighting in some of these areas. So the mutual aid box alarm system from the fire service has brought in some light generators, and we have them at intersections. But much of the area, especially in Hewittville, there is no lights. There are no street lights. There's nothing. So we want to keep the people off the street if we can for safety reasons, and it seems to be working quite well.
And for those who have lost their homes, how are they being taken care of in the community?
Most of them are staying with family and relatives. There is a shelter that's opened up that we have here in town. We are asking for donations, monetary donations. I can give you that information here if you like, but we're trying to help those people out with monetary donations to assist them. There's food and water being provided to them, and we're trying to help them out as much as we can.
And for the people who are listening all over the state who do want to help, Les, what are the ways? You're saying you're taking monetary donations. How can they do that? Where and how else can they help?
Well, right now we prefer the monetary donations because, one, we don't know all the needs right now. We're still assessing a lot of that, and we don't want to take in a lot of equipment that maybe we don't need. So we prefer the monetary donations, and that can be given at Missions for Taylorville, care of the City Hall. And that address is 115 North Main Street, Taylorville, Illinois, 62568.
And we'll make sure to include that in our web posting of this story later on today. And Les, for everybody in your community, this has got to be such a traumatic experience. How is everyone feeling?
Well, I think, you know, at first there's that initial shock, but everybody started pulling together. I mean, we have neighbors helping neighbors, and people that weren't affected are helping those on the other side of town. Yesterday, there was no school in Taylorville. Many of those students were out helping. I mean, the football team, the basketball team were out over the weekend helping clear debris and things. And yesterday they were handing out flyers on how people can get assistance. So the community is pulling together and really uniting. And it's really great to see.
That's Les Albert with Christian County's Emergency Management Agency. Les, I want to thank you so much for taking time in what I know is just a crazy time period. We wish you all the best, and we really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, Liz.
So meteorologist Andrew Pritchard, as I mentioned, is also joining us today, actually inside our Urbana studios. Andrew, if we could just break down what happened in Illinois this past weekend. Was it surprising to you at all that we got these tornadoes? What was it like in comparison to past times at this particular time of year?
Well, it's always surprising to get a tornado outbreak of this nature during the winter in this area. To have so many tornadoes in December, you're never really expecting that well in advance. But this storm system was something that was consistently forecast within the weather models that we're looking at. There was good agreement across the board with those several days in advance. So as we started getting closer, it was becoming clear that we would be dealing with at least some form of severe weather in parts of Illinois on Saturday. And then when we got into about 24 to 48 hours in advance, then it became clear that there was going to be some tornado potential as well.
So when you're saying it became clear, I'm sure there are definite weather patterns that you're looking at, things that are just right, that are lining up, that are making it so this can happen. What are some of those weather patterns and things that people can be looking out for?
Well, the first thing that we noticed days in advance was the storm system showed up, and it was already forecasting ample instability, which is kind of the fuel, the warm, moist air. You know, it was 60 degrees on Saturday afternoon.
After a cold snap.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And so I know that triggers a lot of alarm bells, even with residents. You know, when it's warm, they kind of expect that's going to come crashing down in some fashion. So when we started to see that, the instability was going to be present with this dynamic storm system, it really became, again, clear that we're going to be dealing with something a little unusual.
So where exactly throughout Illinois did they see this instability and tornadoes? We've heard a lot of different numbers. I think I saw 22 at some point, definitely over 20. So where did we see this activity happening throughout the state?
Sure. Right now, the number is at 26, and I know that's subject to change as they're still completing some of the surveys out there. And that was most frequent, the most tornadoes were in western into southwestern Illinois, getting into central Illinois. They started to kind of die out as the sun set on Saturday evening. We started to lose some of that instability as the storms began to move across central Illinois. But certainly there was enough, remaining when the storm reached Taylorville, and that continued up through parts of central Illinois into McLean County and Ford County, where they still had tornado warnings and a couple of brief tornadoes reported. So it was really widespread across central and western.
It really was. Yeah. If you were watching the map, it was all over, really. And then Miss Champaign-Urbana somehow. But I know that you get asked this question every time, but it's such an important question. And I'd really like you to talk about the steps that people are to take to stay safe when a tornado is coming to their community, or at least weather that could produce a tornado.
Well, I think the biggest thing, and something I'm really trying to hit hard these days, is to have a weather radio in your house, a NOAA weather radio. It should be just as common as a fire or a smoke detector, a carbon monoxide detector. You should have a weather radio because that has been proven to be the most effective way to receive these important weather alerts, whether it's a watch or a warning. You know, if you have one of those, you would have been alerted several hours in advance that there was a tornado watch in the area. The second, there's several apps that are out there available for smartphones. Almost everyone's got those. They're carrying it around with them everywhere they go. Mm-hmm. NOAA has a great weather app. FEMA has one as well. And those can actually push the warning information directly to your phone as well.
And is there anything else you'd like people to know as far as severe weather, staying safe, tornadoes, that sort of thing in the community?
Well, I think a big lesson we can learn here is that Mother Nature doesn't care about the calendar. When you start hearing that severe weather and tornadoes are in the forecast in December, you want to take that seriously. And the same goes for if a warning is issued. You know, you see a tornado warning in December, maybe don't brush it off. Make sure you're taking it seriously at all times of the year.
Well, and Taylorville and Christian counties are just starting the process of recovering and rebuilding after this natural disaster. And that process can take a while, long after we stop talking about it and the cameras go somewhere else. So Gary Munier knows this firsthand. He's the mayor of Washington, Illinois. That's just about 20 minutes east of Peoria. And you may recall that 5 years ago, a tornado hit his town round about this time of year, a little bit earlier in November. So Mayor Munier, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm sure you've been following the news these past days, and we just heard from Les about what Christian County is going through. What went through your mind as you heard that story of Taylorville being hit?
Well, obviously, thoughts and prayers went out immediately on Saturday night as people were getting hit, and as we, you know, were prepared and watching and things. And then, you know, as days pass, you know, I've talked with Mayor Barry a couple times, and not telling him what to do, just asking if he needs any help in any way, and advice of what we did. And Joplin helped us a lot. I talked with Mark Rohr and Joplin. It helps just getting an ear and listening to someone that has maybe been through it. But I know exactly where they're at day one, day two, day three. And unfortunately, when that happens, you start reliving what happened to us 5 years ago.
Well, and it has been 5 years for you guys. How often does the tornado come up in day-to-day life in Washington, Illinois these days?
Well, an example, we had our basketball team was in Peoria, Bartonville area, to play basketball that night. And the tornado sirens were sounding, and I ended up coming back to Washington instead of staying at the basketball game. But they ended up canceling, just one, because of what our kids had been through. And coach felt that with the severe tornado type of activity in the area, it was probably best to get people back home and with their families.
Of course.
So it does every time, you know, we see the weather forecast, and it's getting better and better. I mean, the forecast that we receive, we knew on Friday night that there was a possibility on Sunday that something not as traumatic as we had, but that something could be different.
And if you'd allow me to go back to the first few days after the tornado, it must have been a complete whirlwind, but three people lost their lives and about 1,000 homes were hit in your community. Obviously, some of the most immediate needs are medical care, food, shelter for people who have lost their homes. So what are some of the longer term challenges that you weren't expecting, the things that have taken years past that immediate need?
I think, first of all, you know, obviously Friday night or Saturday night, even folks here were gathering medicine and you know, possibly baby pictures, movies and things, and taking it to the basement with them, and because people know that those were some of the treasured values that were lost.
Right.
As far as the first immediate thing is, and I told Mayor Barry the same thing, debris removal. The faster you get the debris out of the way, the faster you can recover. And that was Joplin's advice. But, you know, Joplin's was in the springtime. Ours was, again, November 13th or November 17th. So we knew that debris couldn't lay there the whole winter. And, unfortunately, Taylorville's in the same position.
Well,
so debris removal is important.
And I know that when a disaster strikes the community, people who live there want to make sure that the disaster isn't the only thing that people know about their town. So we thought it was really important that our listeners tuning in from all over the state hear from you. What do you want people to know about Washington, Illinois, outside of the tornado that hit 5 years ago?
Well, I think we're a great community. We're, you know, a very giving community. We love our neighbors. We have a festival in the spring of the year that's called Good Neighbor Days, and you know, we're located, you know, near Peoria and not too far from Bloomington Normal, but we want to be known for, you know, obviously our schools and our parks and our community center to be remembered for a disaster. I think what helps though is what kind of community you have before the disaster helps you recover after disaster. People want to stay here and they want to live, and they enjoy being part of the community, and I think that helps. Joplin lost 4.9% population. We've increased since our 2013 tornado.
Oh, wow. That's such a great note to end on. I want to thank Mayor Gary Monier of Washington, Illinois, meteorologist Andrew Pritchard. Both of you, thanks so much for taking your time to be with us here today on the 21st.
Happy to.
You're welcome.
And that is all the time we have for today. You can, of course, check us out on Twitter. Search for T21ST Show. We'll live tweet during our shows, but you can also check in for more analysis and catch up on all of our shows. Facebook, of course, you can find us at The 21st, and you can like us. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, Alan Montecilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I am Liz Westfield. In for Nyla Boodoo, The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening. Name.